sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. In this repeat episode from our archives, which was first published a little bit earlier in 2020, my guest is David Brock. Dave is the CEO of Partners in Excellence and the author of an excellent book titled The Sales Manager Survival Guide. And he's also, what he self-described, a ruthless pragmatist. And Dave joined me to talk about developing an effective sales execution framework. Now, as Dave described it, increasingly salespeople and managers struggle to make sense of all the things they're being asked to do and how these activities fit with each other. So in this conversation, we dig into Dave's suggested sales execution framework, and it's built around four jobs sellers have to execute simultaneously: demand gen, solving their customers' problems, being in control of their business, and designing high-value meetings. And we'll also dive into how managers can use the sales execution framework to identify systemic shortfalls in their sales process. So all of this and much, much more. Before we get to Dave, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it with Dave Brock. Dave Brock, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Andy. It's always great to talk to you. So, and thanks for inviting me back again. I really appreciate it.
Well, there's never any question that we'd invite you back. So you look like you're enjoying yourself outside somewhere in sunny California.
It's one of the few times I am in sunny California, and I'm sitting outside the local library. I've been finishing my second book, so the library is a good place to do it without distraction.
True, true. As long as people aren't coughing and sneezing on you.
Right.
Since we're recording this in the midst of the legitimate panic, I think, about our concern, let's say, about the coronavirus. So, we're going to jump into a couple things real quickly here. So one is, I want to talk about your sales execution framework. And this is part of your last book. But something that seems like it's come back to sort of the top of the mind for you. Why is that?
What it is, I start working with executives in sales organizations. There really needs to be some rethinking of kind of almost back to basics. I think we've gone through kind of all these miracle cures and these wonderful technologies that aren't producing the results. And you start saying, what produces the results? Well, it's basic principles of selling that somehow we've forgotten about. So number one. Number two is it's doing the whole job. I mean, I think we read so much about cold calling and prospecting. If we only did enough cold calling and prospecting, everything else would be good. But, you have to do pipeline management, deal management, account management, territory management. And if you don't do all those pieces, parts in the right mix, you ultimately fail.
Well, you make the comment. You said that salespeople and managers are struggling with make sense of all that they're being asked to do. And you start reading off the list: territory planning, account planning, deal planning, executing a sales process. Actually, at 14, 15 if you counted other. But pipeline management, forecasting, value creation, da da da. Haven't we always sort of had that responsibility in sales? Why is it increasingly difficult?
Well, we always have, but I think we've taken our eye off the ball quite a bit. and we tend to get intensely focused in one area and not realize how the pieces parts are connected, and you have to do the whole job. The other thing I think is that we don't really identify the right leverage points for driving performance. And you know, when all you have is a hammer, pretty soon everything looks like a nail. Well, we have a whole set of tools that we have to use kind of appropriately across everything that we do. And again, I think too much recently I've seen people lose sight of that and just, you know, focus on one area, then the next area, then the next area, rather than kind of doing the whole job. And again, going back to some of the basic fundamentals of what drives high performance selling.
Well, do you think that part of the reason we've taken the eye off the ball is that there's sort of this working assumption that I think many in sales have, is that, you know, all these wonderful tools and technology we have actually sort of do the work for you?
I think that's a huge amount of it. Wishful thinking or whatever it is that, you know, we have the promise of the tools. If, you know, if we just had this AI tech capability, is we don't have to do anything, and the tools provide us all those sorts of things. Or if we had these other kinds of technologies, the tools give us the answers. And too often what we do, what I see, and this is probably not politically correct, but I see us dumbing the sales organization down and not really giving them the capability to do the critical thinking, the problem solving, to engage customers in the way they need to be engaged. And whether it's relying on a technology, relying on the latest fad in sales, or just copying what everybody else is doing and not doing it very well. I think, again, we have to get back to kind of what are the fundamentals of how we engage customers? What are the fundamentals of how we create value? Where should we be spending our time, and how do we do it in the most effective ways possible?
The point being is that people, could be managers, could be sellers, are distracted by, oftentimes, I believe, by, hey, we've got the ability to collect all this data, so let's just focus purely on the metrics as opposed to the performance that you're talking about.
And it's focusing on kind of bright, shiny objects and those kinds of things where, you know, again, you look at it is the fundamentals. You know, when you strip things back to the fundamentals and you start working on those, it's amazing how quickly you start producing results. And, you know, as we've introduced this concept called the sales execution framework, we just see, you know, the ability to kind of refocus on what's important, identify the leverage points, we find time to results really stunning. I have one client we work with, forecast accuracy was a huge issue with them. And within 6 months, we've moved forecast accuracy from less than 60% to 92%. We've moved win rates, you know, from around, this was actually a pretty good company, around 40% up to about 70%. And there's no magic to it. It's just looking at, are we paying attention to how we execute? Are we focusing on doing the right things with the right people at the right time? And do we do that repetitively and systematically?
So you get a sense from listening to you talk about it and reading your work on the sales execution framework, that, and I sort of feel this way from time to time too, is that, you know, there's really nothing new in sales. You talk about people being sort of obsessed with the bright, shiny object, but what you're talking about are, again, fundamentals that have been in existence for some time. And yeah, we get, go back to the earlier point, maybe we're just getting distracted by all the noise and the bright, shiny objects. You still have to do these fundamentals.
It's the basic principles, and the fundamentals are the same. You know, we have maybe different ways of expressing them. We have technology that helps us do some of those things a little bit more efficiently. But still is, you know, again, I think we've been distracted from executing those fundamentals and doing them day in and day out. When we talk to people and we get them back to those things, again, it's amazing how quickly you start producing results.
So here's a hypothetical for you, because I was having this discussion with somebody just this week, and because I'd read your sales execution framework again, I was sort of thinking about, you've got these four cores, which we're going to get into in a second, but if you're executing the basics in today's business environment, could you as a sales organization produce as much without the tools and technologies if you just focused on the basics as you could selling with the tools and technology?
I'll answer that in maybe a little bit different way. I think if you aren't doing the fundamentals and the basics well, technology isn't going to help you. I mean, the technology will enable you to create crap at the speed of light. So if you're executing, the foundation is executing the basics well, then you can leverage technology on top of that to help make you more efficient to be able to do more. But it all starts with kind of those foundations, and absent those foundations, again, you create crap at the speed of light. And I think that's what we've seen is people have gotten distracted from the foundations to the technology, to the, you know, the latest gee whiz kinds of things, whether it's technology or social selling or social media or, you know, the latest seminar they went to, is that they've gotten away from those fundamentals. And we see that in the results. I mean, we see survey after survey, year after year, of showing declining sales performance and declining sales results.
So the client that you referenced with you driving the win rate from 40s up to the 70s, what type of business are they in?
It's a high technology systems business, hardware, software, solutions, that kind of thing. I'm doing it with a very, very multi-billion-dollar professional services business. And we're starting to see, you know, we're starting with a fundamental issue around pipeline quality and pipeline integrity, and then getting them to focus on, you know, trying to figure out what the gaps in the pipeline are, and then focus on, you know, how we improve win rates on the deals, how we improve average transaction size. You know, we're now, we have an initiative around $20 million to $100 million opportunities to say, how do we double our win rates on that? And we're seeing the ways of just, again, it's not magic, it's disciplined thinking and problem solving about how we can move the needle and dramatically increase the win rates on those things. And those kinds of deals really move the needle in performance. And it has nothing to do with tools.
Right. So a question I was sort of driving to is, so do you think you could, using this framework, that a company could replicate that same success, a SaaS company could replicate that same success? Because here's a segment where the win rates, you know, trend around 20%, low 20s, maybe mid-20s. What would be the key? Because there's what I think oftentimes it seems like they're hamstrung by the technology as opposed to being benefited from the technology. Is what's the key in your mind to work with a SaaS company, get their win rate up to 40, 50%?
Well, I mean, the SaaS company is, they're selling some sort of solution, some sort of tool. I mean, I think we really misunderstand SaaS. I mean, SaaS is a technology. It happens to be a cloud-based implementation. SaaS is a payment system that's a monthly subscription thing. SaaS has been popularized as, you know, through predictable revenue of being a sales methodology, which actually is highly transactionalizing the sales process. And where that works, where a transactional sales process is the right approach, it's a very, very powerful approach. What we're starting to see, though, is some very big limitations. If you think of the grandfather of all kind of the SaaS approach, which is Salesforce.com, is they turned the world of selling and buying CRM upside down from rather these large enterprise deployments to looking at individuals and departments and making it more of a transactional fast sale. You know, for $150-some-odd a seat, I could equip all my people and get them using Salesforce to tomorrow. And it was a relatively small and low risk kind of investment. Well, now as they're, you know, look at trying to say, how do we close 10,000 seats at a time? How do we close a marketing platform, a sales platform, a service platform, and an analytics platform in a very, very large enterprise? The sales approach needed to sell that kind of solution, even though it's the same products, is a very, very different sales approach. And I think what we've lost in a lot of sales leadership is that critical thinking to say, what's the right way to engage these customers? How do we engage them? Not how do we, just because we sell a SaaS product, we use this SaaS sales technique. And we see so many, we get actually so many clients or SaaS companies that say, you know, my sales approach has broken down. It doesn't work anymore. Well, you know, the issue is you're selling to an enterprise. So it's a complex decision with, the 11 plus decision makers and right. very confusing buying cycle. And you used to sell it in the transactional process where you were selling to you, Andy, to buy a seat or for your team to buy a seat. And so that process is very different, and you don't get people thinking about how has that buying process changed, and am I aligning my sales process with that buying process?
Which speaks to, I think, one of the fundamental issues is that alignment, as far as I can tell, rarely happens. Is that, you know, you and I both have seen Gartner's research on the buyer enablement journey of the spaghetti yeah. diagram they talk about with, you know, the complex buying process or decision-making process or buying process, whatever you want to call it, that buyers go through. And yet I see very few companies that have said, well, okay, we got to change the way we sell in order to align with that, where we're still, you know, I need a linear stage-based process, blah, 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 blah. What have you seen in terms of companies adapting how they sell to this reality that Gartner outlined?
There are far too few doing it. You know, the leading companies, you know, whether they're driven into it by necessity because they're failing and they need to reinvent themselves, or whether they're really astute leaders that are thoughtful about how they engage their customers, and all, but far too few people are doing it. And again, I think we see that in, you know, declining overall sales results. We see the CSO Insights research every year where we see fewer and fewer people making quota. We see, you know, greater turnover in sales leadership and in sales people. So we see all these signs that say we are failing to perform as a profession. And we don't see that many people thoughtfully saying, how do I fix this? You know, it seems that, you know, I mean, part of it is the incremental cost of another 10,000 phone calls or another 10,000 emails is virtually zero. So our answer to everything is, if I'm not making my numbers now, rather than think about why I'm not making my numbers, is let me just double them. Let me just double the number of phone calls I make. Right. Let me just double the number of emails I make. And if that doesn't work, then I'll double it again, and so on and so forth. So, you know, rather than sitting back and saying, this isn't working, why isn't it working? How do we change to get something that's much more impactful? Is, you know, largely because of technology, the incremental cost of volumes is virtually zero. So our answer is always to increase volumes. You know, I've always thought, what if we went to, what if every sales person had to pay the price of a first class stamp for every email they sent? Or what if they had to pay 25 cents for every phone call they made, every dial they made? How would that change our approach to things like that? I remember years ago when I was funding, when my marketing teams would come to me and say, we want to run this direct mail program and it's going to cost us this much per piece and so on and so forth. And I'd say, well, are we really going to get results out of it? And because that was costing us hard money, we went into it more thoughtfully. It didn't mean that we were successful, but we became much more thoughtful and much more discriminating since technology has made the incremental cost of volume virtually zero. We've stopped thinking about those things, and our answer to every performance problem is just do more volume.
Well, that was really at the heart of the question I asked you originally about, you know, could you sell successfully in today's environment without technology? It was not advocating that you should, but it's saying if you had to be extremely thoughtful and about how you would attack that problem, I suspect you'd find an answer. But it requires a level of thought that I agree that people seem to be wanting to sort of bypass because there's an easy way to get more volume, right, as you discussed. So, which is a good segue into talking about your framework, because your framework is built around your sales execution framework, built around four areas: demand gen, solving our customers' problem, being in control of our business, and my favorite, designing high value meetings. So let's talk about those in order. So demand gen, explain what you mean. I mean, I think we know pretty much, but tell us what you meant in that context.
Demand gen is how do we identify and find new opportunities? And we can kind of look at it in a couple of different dimensions. Using old-fashioned sales terms, it's, you know, territory management or it's account management. You know, basically, I think sometimes we overcomplicate account planning. Is account planning at its core is a structured prospecting process.
Right.
I remember, you know, in the old days of territory planning, we used to do these things. We look at, you know, what SIC codes are in this territory, you know, and we make sure, are we covering here the customers, the SIC codes that are in our sweet spot? Have we identified every one of those? Or, you know, I remember in the old days when I used to drive around in a car, we did something called smokestack hunting because I called on manufacturing accounts. You know, and every time I saw a smokestack, I'd go in and prospect there. So, you know, so there we're talking about structured prospecting approaches that say, who's our target customer? How do we approach them? How do we engage them? And are we approaching them in a sufficient volume? Well, I don't know that volume or what's sufficient in terms of the volume until I know my sales process and my opportunity management process. And then until I know kind of my win rates, my average deal size, and my transaction values, you know, and so now, now as we start looking at the whole thing as a system, we can start saying, you know, what are the right numbers or where are the leverage points? So I pose this example to people. Imagine two salespeople. They both have exactly the same quotas. Let's imagine their quotas are $5 million. Both have exactly the same pipeline. Let's imagine their pipelines are $10 million. Mm-hmm. Salesperson A has a win rate of 40%. Salesperson B has a win rate of 20%. What do you do? So most sales managers say, oh, Dave, that's obvious. Prospect more. They need more pipeline. And I say, okay, cool. Why? You know, and they say, well, we need three times pipeline. So they have to build their pipeline from 10 million to 15 million. And I say, well, why are you choosing three times pipeline? Well, that's what sales managers always do, is we always have to have three times pipeline. And I said, well, with salesperson A, you might actually be decreasing their productivity because they only need $12.5 million of pipeline to make their numbers. They're pretty good at making their numbers. They only need 12.5. And if you're forcing them to get 15 million, you're distracting them from the things that cause them to be very, very effective.
Well, yeah, they just don't have the time to work the accounts the way they should. So
exactly. So you do that. Salesperson B, you know, you get three times pipeline, but they need five times pipeline to make their numbers. So if they get three times pipeline, they still aren't going to make their numbers. And then you start saying, is getting them to prospect the most impactful thing they can do, because they suck at selling, and so they're going to suck even more at prospecting.
Right.
What if I first start focusing on improving their win rate, and that changes their pipeline dynamics, it changes their effectiveness.
Absolutely.
And starts doing some things. So what happens is we see these sales managers not really thinking and analyzing performance and the performance levers. They just come up with these kind of rote answers, and the answers aren't serving us. And so we have to dig in deeper and see, where are the leverage points? Where are the leverage points with the organization? Where are the leverage points with each individual? And how do we start coaching those individuals to maximize their performance?
Yeah, and I think the one thing sales managers don't do enough of is reverse engineer their process, is they start at the top and do the math, you know, down, as opposed to saying, I want a win rate of this. You know, they'll say, usually they go, well, to win a deal, I need, you know, 5 qualified opportunities, I need 15 leads, so I'm going to have, you know, 45, as opposed to saying, we should be able to have a 40% win rate. So what does that mean in terms of how we prospect, who we prospect to, and then the rest of the process that builds on top of that? And I've seen examples of what you talked about where, two salespeople with disparate skill sets, and the answer is always more, as opposed to how do I make this person better first, and then let's see what we can do.
Yeah. In our company, we spend a lot of time kind of understanding that and analyzing it. And so we have things like our win rate in our company is somewhere between 82% and 90%. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much because we're great salespeople, even though we are. It's
of course.
Because we're viciously focused on our sweet spot, and we don't waste our time outside that sweet spot. Mm-hmm. So we know where we have, very, very high win rates. And then, so that changes our pipeline dynamics tremendously. We don't have to have huge pipelines. We don't have to be prospecting thousands and thousands of people, because our pipeline dynamics, our deal size, and so on and so forth are such that we make the most out of everything that we do. And so I think it's our business is helping people do that, so we think a lot about it. But what I don't see is many sales executives doing the same thing with their organizations and identifying the leverage points. Like I mentioned, this client I'm working with right now is, we looked at the leverage points and we said their win rates on these very, very large deal sizes is really unsatisfactory. And the best thing we can do to drive performance is figure out how to increase the win rates. Part of it is, are we chasing the right opportunities? Part of it is, are we engaging the customer as effectively as possible? And it turns out when you start looking at it, it becomes really easy to start identifying, if I do this, I'm going to improve it. If I do this, I'm going to improve it. And you can start systematizing that in really producing results. And again, this one, we've raised the win rate with this particular client. We're trying to move win rates actually from 20% to 40%. We're up to about 30% right now with a few just small changes in improvements in kind of focus.
Well, and to your point, precisely, your account planning, your structured prospecting process, too often now, again, this is more, you see it more in SaaS companies, is they fall behind and suddenly managers want pipeline coverage rates to go from 3 to 5, you hear 7, you hear 9, and it seemingly never occurs to the people in charge that they are entering into a vicious cycle from which there's no exit when they do that, and that the math is pretty simple, as your win rate is basically going to be the reciprocal of your pipeline coverage ratio. And at some point, you got to bite the bullet and say, we got to be more effective, to your point, at the top in how we do our account planning, our territory planning.
Or things like, what if I improve my win rate by being better at disqualifying? What if I improve my pipeline dynamics by being better at defending price? So I don't have to discount as much and I can raise my average deal size and things like that. So there are lots of levers that we can pull to drive sales performance, not just the volume and velocity lever. And that's what the sales execution framework's all about, is what are those levers?
Right. So the first thing, lead gen, we just beat that one up. Second, solving our customers' problems. Why is that so hard these days?
Well, the cynical answer is we're interested in what we sell, not the customer's problems. It's amazing how simple selling becomes if you start focusing on the customer and their problems and how to do that, and how to help them solve the problems. The problems, and you've seen the Gartner data as well as I have, the problems customers have is less around solution selection, but more about what are they trying to achieve in their business, what are their goals, what's standing in the way of doing that, how do they orchestrate this large, complex buying process and make sense of that whole thing. And so we as salespeople focus on the product selection piece, which is the smallest part of the problem that the customer is solving.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. When I sort of deconstructed my success in selling large enterprise deals, is a different way of saying it at the time, but it was like I was focused on trying to say, if I could be the seller that helped shape the customer's vision of how they were going to solve their problem, that when they'd move then to the next step of trying to choose who they wanted to solve it with, I was in the driver's seat.
Yep.
And this is, classic IBM selling from decades ago. But this is, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is a part that is just almost completely absent from so many sellers, individual sellers as well as managers' perspectives, is what's the job I'm really setting out to do here with solving the customer problem? It's not solving the problem by helping them choose me. It's solving the problem by helping them decide, helping them choose how they're going to solve their problem.
Well, and if you're in there helping them solve their problem, they almost always default to you, or you're in the most favored position, because you're defining the ball game and the ground rules. And helping them define that. So you're always doing that in a way that, I think we got to make sure we're chasing after customers whose problems we can solve and not wasting our time on customers that aren't. But once we do that and then we focus on solving their problems, we're always in the most favored position.
Yeah, I think an analogy for salespeople to keep in mind about this is that they're focused on the end target, which is getting the order, when they should be focused on an intermediate target, which is helping the customer decide how they're going to solve their problem. And I was reading something several years ago about golf, and I'm not a big golfer, but I have played occasionally. But pro golfers, when they're lining up their shot, I know Tiger Woods does this, Jack Nicklaus did it, is they're not aiming at where they want the ball to land. They've picked out an intermediate target, like 10 yards, 15 yards, 20 yards in front of them, that they're really aiming the ball at. If the ball passes over that target, it'll end up eventually where they want it, 200, 300 yards down the fairway. And I think that's really, at least in my mind, is analogous to what we should be doing in sales, is the intermediate target is the most important one. And we don't have a chance to win the deal if we don't help the customer make that choice about how they want to solve their problems. Otherwise, if it's not based on us, it'll be based on somebody else. And we're just going to be competing on price, trying to, persuade them not to go with the people they really think they should go with.
Yeah. And so, again, I think part of it is we don't get the purchase order until the customer figures out this is the problem I want to solve and this is what I'm going to do to solve it. And if we're guiding them down that, they start solving their problem and we get the purchase order.
Yeah, but sellers, I think about this in two steps. First step, how are we going to solve this problem? You look at the Gartner spaghetti diagram we talked about before. There's four jobs that Gartner identified that buyers need to accomplish in their buying process: identifying a problem, researching solutions, finalizing building their specification or requirements, choosing a vendor. So three of those four had nothing to do with vendor selection.
Right.
And so when you think about that, and also on that chart, which is a huge, complex, flow chart, the word sales only shows up once.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how that works, but it's funny how what we do is we pay attention to that sales piece. We pay attention to that presenting our solution, where that's the smallest part of the customer's buying process, so we aren't being as helpful as we could to them.
Yeah, and the reason the sales only shows up once, I believe, is because this is, they were surveying buyers, and the buyers are reflecting their perception of the value they get from sellers in the main, right? We can do this largely without a seller. They would rather be able to do it with the seller if you can add value to them and help them make a better choice.
And I think that's where a lot of people are misreading the data, misreading the literature. It's not that people don't want to deal with salespeople. It's just that salespeople aren't being as helpful as they can be. So customers are forced to look for that help someplace else, whether it's, you know, peers that they talk to, whether it's letting their fingers walk through Google and do research and things like that. But it's not an aversion to salespeople. It's they need help and they need answers, and they're going to go anywhere they can to get those answers. And if it's a salesperson giving them those answers, they'll embrace that salesperson and work with them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's only aversion to salespeople who waste their time.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So your third pillar in your sales execution framework was being in control of our business. What do you mean by that?
And really that's saying, you know, what are the dynamics of our business? You look at it from kind of a pipeline management and opportunity management point of view. So an example, very large organization I'm working with right now, you know, they said, you know, I said, well, tell me, you know, are you in control of your business? Are you going to make your numbers? And how do you know? And they said, oh, our pipeline looks great. And I said, oh, okay, that's cool. Let's look at the pipeline. Well, you know, they had, you know, the right coverage on it, but then you start looking at the deals. There were 30% of the deals that had projected close dates in the past. And I said, is anybody paying attention to these 30% of the deals? You know, they were supposed to close some of them a year and a half ago. What's happened to them? And so, I mean, and that seems like a silly example, but
the way managers, you know, fluff up their pipeline. They just don't let things out of it.
People do these things. And so you say, well, you're really not in control of your business. You don't know what's happening. You don't know whether you're chasing enough of the right opportunities, the high quality opportunities to make your numbers this month, this quarter, this year. You look at things kind of at a nominal level and say, I have 3x coverage in my pipeline, but you don't look at the quality of that pipeline and the dynamics within it. You know, this same customer, you know, one of my favorite fields within Salesforce is the number of times the close date changes. I was sitting a couple of years ago with a salesperson. He had a very, very large deal. And he said, it's closing at the end of this month. I said, how do you know? He says, trust me, it's closing at the end of this month. But I said, well, if I look at the history, you've been working on this deal for 12 months and you've changed the close date 11 times. Why should I believe you this time?
Soon to be 12.
Right, exactly. So, you know, there's this lack of discipline, lack of focus, in lack of, you know, you do look at the numbers and say, this stuff doesn't make sense. And as a result, these people aren't in control of the business.
And it seems what you're describing, though, is that, again, not to put the blame on the numbers per se, but we've had such an increased focus on numbers that I think part of it is to see this behavior that people are reluctant to let things go. And you know, they're fooling themselves, right? It's just a form of self-deception. Yeah, I've got this huge pipeline, you know, 30% of it's basically inactive. They haven't told us no, but if they're inactive, they told you no, right?
You gotta
learn to let that go. I mean, managers has to start there at the top, is have to let this stuff go. And bite the bullet, if that's what it takes, and then engage in this framework that you're talking about, let's go back and look at our prospecting, structured prospecting process. Let's look and see if we really are in charge, which is one of the hardest steps that for managers to take, is they're afraid to do that.
I think it goes even a little bit more deeply. I think we look at the numbers, we focus on the numbers, but we don't understand what the numbers mean. You know, in some sense, the numbers are just a red flag. You know, but sure. You know, once I see that red flag, I have to get and say, what's causing this to happen? And then what do I do about that? And so too much of what I see managers and salespeople doing is they're just looking at the numbers themselves and not what caused the numbers.
Well, and I think that's an interesting perspective, because when you look at your framework, certainly from that perspective, is really what this is you could say a sales execution framework, but it's really a sales problem-solving framework.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's, you know, and the other thing too is it shows that all the pieces, parts of what we do are connected. So what we do in territory development and account development impacts our opportunity strategies and our deal strategies in our sales process, which impacts our pipeline, which impacts our forecast. And all those are, you know, and how do we execute those? Those are based on high quality value added sales calls and meetings. Mm. And so we have to look at all of these things together. And the moment we start isolating them, we start, you know, missing important pieces of information and important interconnections between these.
And do you think that a lot of this is driven by the fact that people are sort of so wedded to the process that, you know, they, every time they see something, they try to fit it into a niche of something that they're familiar with, as opposed to saying, well, this is new. How do I analyze this differently than something I'm familiar with, right? They get so stuck in their patterns that everything fits into a certain box, but what if this is different? What if it's not the same? And how do we address that? It seems superficial thinking, I guess, is part of the issue.
But I think that's really an important point. If we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and it isn't working as well as it used to be, we have to start asking ourselves, have things changed? Is this different? And if things have changed and it's different, do I need to change and adapt what I'm doing?
Yeah. Well, it sort of sprung to mind because a couple of days ago I was listening to a podcast, Malcolm Gladwell's podcast about doing an episode about, I always pronounce it wrong, causatry, sort of the Jesuit form of deep thinking and problem solving. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of starts with the taxonomy. Is this like a problem we've solved before and encountered before? Or is this different than a problem? And
right.
Rarely see managers take the time to do that type of analysis. And if they did it, to your point way back earlier in the conversation, if you're doing this on a regular basis, you learn more about what you're doing, and perhaps the need to have your 5X pipeline coverage goes away because you're more going to be more effective coming up with ways to solve problems earlier on.
Yeah. And I guess it's attributed to Einstein, but it's you know, the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and to expect a different result.
Yeah. Well, right. And we're doing a lot of that, but we solve it by doing more of it, though.
Well, and see, that's it, is you know, I one of the things, I mean, people think I am weird, but people sometimes think I'm really weird when I go in and I say, let me meet the laziest salesperson in your organization that always makes her number.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because that's a person that's broken the code. They've figured out how to get more done in less time. And instead, we don't kind of look at those things. And we just keep, again, you know, doing the same thing we've always done. It's producing less and less results. So our answer to that is not to rethink what we're doing, but just to do more of that, you know, and try to produce a better result.
So I actually had an argument on this show years ago with a guest who, your story recalled to mind, is she would have fired that saleswoman. and I said, wait, so she says, yeah, if you've got expectations for an organization, you know, you're going to have so much activity in certain dimensions. And her point was, I would care if somebody was 130% of quota, if they weren't, you know, generating enough proposals, they weren't making enough calls. It's like, really? You'd fire that person? Instead of analyzing that person and saying, what do we can learn from this person and take what she's doing and try to apply it to other people? It was just symptomatic, I think, of sort of the blind way that sales organizations are too often run.
Yeah. I mean, what you do with that lazy salesperson is just double their quota, and they'll figure out how to do it in the shortest amount of time as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I was very fortunate in my career to have managers to give me the freedom to go do that, because I didn't want to sell like most of the people I got trained with. It was like, yeah, I don't want to do that. I think there's a better way to do it. I don't know if mine was better, but it was better for me. Worked quite well.
But
if I was fortunate, they didn't try to get me to conform. Otherwise, I'd probably be doing something else these days. So, all right, Dave, last point on that was designing high-value meetings. And as I said before, I love this one because for me, I think one of the most frustrating things when I'm dealing with sales teams and talking to sales leaders is that, and individual contributors, it's like, you realize that sales is a very deliberate business, right? As you have to think deeply about every step as opposed to just, I just got to lockstep follow this process we got to read my scripts, blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, you got to, if you're not in an interaction with a buyer, if they don't have any value, they're not receiving any value from that interaction, you're not going to get another one. Right. Which so often happens, right? So tell us about this idea you have about designing the high-value meetings and the value of being deliberate in how you sell.
So the concept around designing high-value meetings, there are a couple of principles. One is the customer defines value.
Absolutely.
And so each, you know, what's valuable to the customer at this point in time is different from customer to customer, is different today and tomorrow. And so if I want to maximize my ability to engage the customer and create a preference for us, is I'm going to focus on what's most important and what's most valuable to them. And talk about those things and not talk about the things they don't care about, because I'm wasting their time and I'm wasting my time. So that's number one. Number two is now you start looking at how do you amp that up and how do you start creating more results in the meeting. And we started applying some design thinking kind of principles to this. And so I started thinking the principle. We talk about pre-call planning and things like that. So I do my pre-call planning and I'm going to execute something that creates a huge amount of value for the customer. Well, that's kind of one-sided, you know, and so we started thinking, what if the customer comes in as prepared for this meeting as we are? If I'm doing my job as a salesperson and I'm preparing for this meeting, I want the customer to have a really killer meeting. I want the customer to be as prepared as I am in that meeting. So I'm going to, you know, publish an agenda beforehand and agree, you know, we need this information in order for us to move forward with this. Will you be prepared to have that? Are you going to have the right people there so that we can accomplish these things? So we go into this meeting with a set of common objectives for which we are each prepared. And what happens is we accomplish a lot more with the customer in those meetings than if we were prepared and the customer wasn't. And the interesting things are, is one is you create more value for the customer, more bias for you. Two is you actually literally cut the number of meetings in half. We saw that in our own company is we used to have something like 22 meetings per close. And for us, you know, that meant a lot of times jumping on an airplane, which took a lot of time and a lot of expense.
Money, absolutely.
And so what we started doing is we started applying this design thinking to our own meetings and to making sure we were prepared, but also the customer was prepared. And we reduced our calls to close from 22 down to 9.
Well, and I think an interesting perspective on that is because, did something very similar, is that the value is not, I think if you really look at it, the value is not in, you know, the piece of content you provide or the questions you ask or the insights you provide. I think the value to the customer is that as a result of the meeting, they've made progress toward achieving their goal, which is making a decision.
That's exactly it. Helping them move forward.
Right. And that should be the definition of value, in my mind, definition of value for a meeting is, as a result of this meeting, the customer is closer to making a decision than they were before it started. And it requires all things you talked about, pre-call planning on your side, pre-call planning on the part of the customer, an agreement, not only the agenda, but in exchange for the content, whatever you provided that helped make them smarter about the problem, there's a commitment to what next steps are. I mean, all these things, because... Yeah, getting that commitment helps the buyer. You know, it helps them say, "Yeah, we've got putting a frame around the time frame for making this decision." And so, I think, to me, the ultimate definition of value is that just progress. Are we making progress? And we agree that we made progress.
And customers love salespeople who are doing that because they're saying, "You're helping me make progress. You're helping me get to the conclusion." In a way that I may not know how to do because I'm not buying this stuff all the time. I'm not solving these problems all the time. So you're helping me make progress, number one. Number two is you're helping me reduce the amount of time I have to spend on this, rather than, look at the old Gartner spaghetti chart. Is it, I have to go back and forth, and so on. If I can find a way to simplify this, and achieve more in the same amount of time or achieve more in less time, think of the value that you create for each person on that. And we're all time poor, and the customers get really confused with this stuff. So, designing these applying, again, I think taking the design thinking principles and applying that to how we design and conduct meetings, not how we prepare for meetings, is really a game changer.
Right. And I am an advocate for creating a standard definition of productivity for sales. And that definition is just the way economists talk about productivity. It's rate of output per unit of input. So how many dollars of revenue is a seller generating per hour of actual sales time? And I had the fortune to manage sales teams with this long time ago, just given a certain accounting system we had. But you have so much visibility. But to your point about time being the most limiting aspect of it, you want to know what the value of each unit of time is.
Yeah.
And you could take this, I think, to the next step and say, okay, well, if we can figure that out, which is not that hard, is then maybe part of the way we compensate sellers is based on their productivity, not on the ultimate output, right? There's, you can have an expectation from productivity to certain people is the more productive you are, the more you're generating per unit of time, I'll pay you more because that means that means the ultimate productive capacity of my organization is greater.
Yeah. And I think there are different ways we measure this and so on and so forth, and we can tie comp or some other things to it. But it is really is how do we accomplish more in a given unit of time? How do we help our customers accomplish more in a given unit of time?
Well, and that's the key one. Yeah. To me, the great sellers are the ones that do the latter that you just talked about, right? They're the ones that, the description of the woman that was the top seller that, it's like the analogous to the analogous to the basketball player that just makes it look too easy, right? You think they're not trying, but they're actually trying and scoring a ton of points.
And they've figured out how to do that in the most effective way possible. That's a real win.
Yeah, for everybody. Yeah. Seller and customer. All right, Dave. We're going to end it there. We've had a nice long conversation today. As always,
we've covered a lot. We've covered a lot. Yep.
So we'll make sure we do this again. But why don't you tell folks how they can find out more about you? If you're not subscribing to Dave's blog, by the way, you should. It's on my list. I get it all the time. Can't wait to read the nuance. Very thought provoking writing about sales. So tell people they can find out more about you.
That's partnersinexcellenceblog.com. And it's published right now. I'm at about three posts a week. I'm off a little bit. I usually try and do five posts a week. LinkedIn is Dave Brock or David Brock. Twitter is @DavidABrock.
Yeah. And David makes me feel bad because he writes long posts. I don't know how he finds the time to do that, but they're always worth your time. So, Dave, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks, Andy. It's always such a pleasure.
Okay, friends, that's it for this archive episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. So grateful, as always, for your support of this podcast. And I want to thank my friend, Dave Brock, for sharing his wisdom with us. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you could also leave us a rating or a review, let us know how we're doing. Well, we'd certainly appreciate that. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.